What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Nikhil Kolgati is a founding partner at CoVenture Crypto. In this conversation, we discuss his work at SoftBank, how to apply moonshot investing to digital assets, and what CoVenture is currently excited about as the crypto industry continues to mature. This conversation was a ton of fun, and I hope you enjoy it nearly as much as I did.
Before we get started, I want to talk about one of our sponsors, BlockFi. These guys are doing really interesting work in crypto lending. What they allow you to do is keep your crypto, put it up as collateral, and receive a US dollar loan funded directly to your bank account. They do loans ranging from $2,000 to $10 million, and they're perfect for helping you reach your financial goals of all sizes. You should visit BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, that's BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, one more time, type it in, BlockFi.com/pomp, if you'd like to learn more about putting your crypto to work without having to sell it. Definitely do it.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, super excited. I've got Nikhil here. We've got a ton to cover, so I'm not going to blab too much. Just welcome. Let's get this thing started.
Let's do it.
All right. Background. What the hell did you do before you got into crypto?
Was there life before crypto? Basically, I was an engineer. And then I was in military intelligence. It was pretty weird, crazy experience. Worked on some projects that... were actually unbelievable precursors to a lot of blockchain projects that are being developed today. Although I had never uttered or understood the word crypto or blockchain in, you know, the early 2000s. So I started a small investment group while I was doing that, did a master's degree in engineering management, and very quickly I got myself into the startup world. So I was first employee at what is now a decent-sized tech company. And then about a year into that, I was feeling the investment bug. And we were fortunate. We were in this TechStars program, the first one outside of Boulder in Boston in 2008. And Brad Feld came and Jason Mendelsohn. These are, you know, extraordinary guys at Foundry Group, and got to meet them. And about, you know, six to maybe less than a year into it, I told Brad, I said, hey, I love investing. I want to be an investor. I might go to business school. He's like, business school will be the biggest mistake of your life.
So I tend to agree with that.
Now having gone through it, you know, it was an amazing, amazing experience, build incredible connections. You know, Harvard opens up a ton of doors for sure, which frankly I didn't have, prior to. So, got into that, and 6 months in, I applied to my first venture gig, and it was SoftBank. Got it and never looked back. So I've been a venture investor for almost a decade with SoftBank, and with a smaller fund, and started CoVenture Crypto, joined the CoVenture team with Ali, who you know really, really well, Savneet, Atit, who's also here. And it's been an amazing, amazing run. So that's sort of the general career progression. So it's like crypto came late, but the origin story of how did we get into crypto is sort of, you know, a question everybody wants to ask. I think everybody has two origin stories, right? There's the I got lucky and got rich answer. Mm-hmm. And then there's the I'm ideologically aligned with crypto and I'm passionate about it. And whether that makes you a Bitcoin maximalist or whether that makes you, you know, a decentralization maximalist, you know, you're ideologically aligned.
I'm going to cut it two other ways. The first time you heard about crypto and then the first time you did something about it. And those are usually not the same date.
one came a lot later than the other. You can guess which. So check this. There was a entrepreneur at SoftBank. He just left a company called Prosper, I think it was. And a fellow outside of SoftBank had knew him very well, and we become close friends, and he become a business partner of mine later in life. And he said, Nikhil, you got to meet this founder. He's actually a SoftBank guy that you never interacted with. He's moving on. He's starting a new company now. So I went out and flew to meet him, and he's in Silicon Valley. I sat down. He says, Nikhil, here's this crazy idea. It's called a distributed ledger. This is 2011. Okay. And I said, a distributed what? I was like, first, what's a ledger? and so an hour and a half into it, I still didn't understand what the hell he's talking about. But I knew that there was something really special here. So that was Chris Larson, who ended up starting Ripple. And it was an amazing entrance point to learn about cryptocurrency. And subsequent to that, years later, not too many, I had left SoftBank and started exploring cryptocurrency, and we'd made some investments in the next firm that I joined. And then fast forward from there, and it's all in on crypto with a lot of investments. So now we've got, you know, angel investments from my partners and myself, ranging from, you know, there's Coinbase and Ripple and Stellar and Blockstack and Digital Currency Group and a whole bunch of other ones that have been fortunate to allow us to be around the V1 of crypto. Mm-hmm. And now V2 is completely different, and we have a completely different approach to attacking it as an organization, not as a bunch of individuals.
For sure. So before we get into what you guys are doing and how you're approaching it from an investment side, I want to do some role playing. So we've never done this before.
Sounds romantic.
But I want to throw out the name or type of organization of other people in the crypto ecosystem that may be under attack or be in a reactive position to some of this stuff. And you just talk through, if you were in their seat.
So if I was Pomp under attack by Twitter, what would I do?
Oh, the Twitter trolls are easy. I just say, have a great day, and give them a smiley face and a fire emoji. And we move
fire,
on.
Fire, fire. And that's it.
All right. So government. If you're a government or some sort of monetary organization in the fiat world, how do you think about crypto? What would you do as either a reaction or maybe even something to be proactive in responding to it? What's your thoughts there?
Ignore it or shut it down is pretty much the gut response that people will have. I think ignore it is the smart move, considering it's so small that it's kind of irrelevant from a economic perspective on virtually any government around at this point in time. And then ban it has been the other response. And we've seen that in a couple of ways. There's the outright ban, which only like three countries in the world have basically said, we don't care about this. We're just going to say no and not deal with it because they've got bigger humanitarian issues and they have bigger challenges going on in those countries. I think Bangladesh is one country that has a complete and outright ban on it. But I don't think it even ranks. I don't think it's spoken about in the Bangladeshi government, mm-hmm. is my guess. It's just added to the list of things they don't have to worry about, at least. And then and there's others that kind of take the middle ground and say, we like this, we don't like that. Right. China's a good example. The U.S. government's a really good example, where I would call it semi-regulated. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's clear definitions of way things are taxed, and there's clear definitions of way certain pieces are regulated. And there's just so many gray areas that they realize, you know what, this is really too hard for us to deal with right now. Let's figure out the biggest risk areas. Let's make an example of people. So I love what, you know, the SEC has done so far, at least in 2018 in response to ICOs. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have thousands of people on staff in order to address all the holes of innovation that are being created.
We're talking right now in the government shutdown. I don't even know if they have anybody working.
I know. No registrations are going through. No, it's wild. But up until the shutdown, I'd say they were actually quite, you know, they actually had a very, very clear response.
What do you think they should do? So I agree with you that that's what the different ones are doing. If you're...
Let innovation go wild up until it very clearly breaks rules. Mm-hmm. I think that's the right approach. Why? They don't have the resources yep. in order to do much more than that, first of all. Their other option realistically is do nothing. And I think that sends an equally bad message as an overcorrection. So the US government in particular has the most to lose by overcorrecting, mm-hmm. by sending investors abroad as a result of them not being able to do what they want to do here, mm-hmm. is really, really bad for the U.S. government, mm-hmm. especially right now.
What if you're an incumbent financial services company?
So like big bulge bracket banks, things like that.
Payment services or banks?
Look, every bank is just like every other major company that you can think of. They want to make a ton of profits. they're willing to go to extraordinarily great lengths in order to do so. The one thing is that they're not going to throw away the baby with the bathwater when it comes to regulation. Mm-hmm. So they're going to say, we don't believe in this. We think this is BS. We are not supporting this type of activity until they can very extremely clearly look their chief risk officer and head of compliance in the eyes and get the blessing to go full throttle. Meanwhile, in the background, they are spending a ton of resources internally on making sure they've got all the right patents in place, to make sure that their traders are being sophisticated, to make sure that they've actually moved their smartest people into this burgeoning growth area off of whatever area is dying. And the same thing happened in mortgage-backed securities, and the same thing happened in gold, and the same thing happened and every single time there was a massive trend at some of these big banks. They moved some of their greatest talent over right before it was the time to take advantage of it. So don't get me wrong. It's going to be no, no, no. And then it's going to be an quote unquote overnight success that took 2-3 years in the making.
And do you think that a lot of these banks feel like they're under pressure or their core business could be eroded away? Or do you think that they look at this as an additive business where it's just our core business isn't going anywhere. This stuff actually isn't going to attack that. We just have now a new revenue, a potential revenue source when this is has regulatory clarity.
So I spent a lot of 2017, 2018 going around to big banks, teaching them about cryptocurrency, teaching them about blockchain. We hosted classes at our office and at big financial institutions' offices about why they should care about blockchain, why they should care about crypto, and why it makes them more money, not so much less. And I'll tell you, there's a couple different varieties of responses. Right? Invariably, particularly in 2017 and the first half of 2018, there was the classic instance of drug dealers, what is a blockchain kind of conversation. Fine, that's okay. Education is the first step in this whole process. So once we get past that, there was invariably some folks in the room that said, hey, just so everyone knows, I've been mining personally. Like, I think this is a great idea, but they were always the minority in the audience. I won't name which banks, but let's call them, you know, the top five banks in America, you know, by AUM perspective. And now they kind of recognize that this is the reinvention of a lot of their assets. Ironically, to a state where it's kind of like how the world was before banks. So people talk a lot about a barter system, which never really existed in humanity, right? There was effectively a sense of credits and debts that happened well before we even had physical printed money. And in essence, what I'm saying is that there was virtual money before we had physical money. And now we're kind of going back to this post-bank world of virtual money again. And it's a really, really efficient process. It's a lot more complex, obviously, now than it was, you know, 6,000 years ago. But I actually think that most of the processes now will become much more efficient as they become blockchainified, or as they eliminate a lot of middleman resources. I think most of the big banks recognize this. They probably recognize it first in patent defense. Bank of America, I think, has the largest number of patents among companies in the US. By the way, globally, the number one patent holder in the world of blockchain, do you know?
China?
Correct. Which company?
I don't know.
Alibaba.
Ah.
And they had 10% of all patents in 2017. I think it's the latest numbers I have.
Wow.
Pretty wild. The point is that most of those are not due to their e-commerce, and they're due to the financial services group at Tamiami Financial.
So, okay. So that brings me to, if you're a traditional investor or like an incumbent financier, there's been this rise of everything from ICOs, right? So kind of the ability to sell tokens for non-dilutive funding, to tokenized securities, tokenized debt, all the stuff that's kind of coming down the pipe, as ways for entrepreneurs or asset owners to gain access to capital markets. If you're sitting and you're running a traditional venture fund, a traditional private equity fund, you know, even a bank as a lender type situation, how do you think about this space as it's growing, and what would you do if you're sitting in those shoes?
So the first checkbox that needs to be hit is legal. I don't mean regulatory, I mean legal, right? You need to make sure that how are these things actually enforced? Can I get my money out in the event that, you know, there's a default, or in the event that something triggers into another type of asset. And that's probably the hardest challenge that we have right now. I think the regulatory framework follows the legal framework and the regulatory framework depends on what structure there is and the enforceability around it. So that's the first big challenge. When I think of tokens as they're structured right now, security tokens in particular, it's mostly PDFs on a blockchain. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a number of efforts being led out there. I mean, you've seen Spice Trade, and you've seen Spice.vc, I was specifically saying. And then that's sort of version 0.1, mm-hmm. I would say. That's basically just funds that are theoretically tradable, although it's going to be hyper limited in terms of the liquidity. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's V1. What I think happens over the next 2 years is you're going to have this incremental growth that is going to be short-lived. This is not massive step function evolution of these security tokens. This is going to be bit by bit crawling forward, inching forward. Mm-hmm. And we'll look back and say, wow, that was so embarrassing how little distance we moved. But they're really important steps. Mm-hmm. So if we want to get to this goal line, and the goal line is all the stuff you've probably heard and talked about a million times. Every single asset tokenized, all the things that's on the balance sheet of the banks are tokenized, fragmented liquidity, new pathways of capital flowing. You know, you've got debt that upon these triggers turns into X, Y, and Z because it's all in a smart contract globally. That'll be great, right? Mm-hmm. But in order to get there, we're going to need just to do the simple stuff. Like, what if we just increased accessibility to existing products that already are around today? I'm not saying you open a door that's never been opened. I'm saying the door's already open. People can go and buy this product.
Yep.
But we're going to open the door an inch more through tokenization. Mm-hmm. A good example is you can go ahead. I ask everyone this, like, do you own any of the FANG stocks? Right? And you say yes. And then I say, wow, well, it's obvious why you'd own the FANG stocks, right? The highest growth sector for the last 5 years in the US. And, you know, they're super popular. You're probably a user of those stuff. So you're very familiar with the companies. And, you know, they're traded with an extreme amount of liquidity, blah, blah, blah. But do you own any of the FANG of China? China's been growing extraordinarily over the last 5 years. Let's not count the last 3 months of emerging markets crash, but last 5 years generally. Do you even know what the FANG of China is? Mm-hmm. chances are, in one of the highest growth countries of the world, in the highest growth sectors in the world, in one of the most popular products in the world, that's going to be a decent bet over that period of time. But people don't. And they don't really know that, you know, you can actually go online and buy these really, really easily. Do you have a Fidelity account? Mm-hmm. You could probably figure out a way to do it. But my mom has a Fidelity account. She has no idea what A-shares are. She has no idea how to put a wrapper around a Chinese listed stock. And I can tell you, if someone went to her and said, hey, give me your cash, I'll turn it into whatever the Chinese listed stock is, that would be great. The trick is, the product that this person's offering my mom is, I'll take your money, I'll turn it into some Bitcoin, I'll buy it for the swap exposure to a publicly listed product, and bam, there you go. You've got a new product that basically did not do anything innovative in the world other than gave someone exposure to a completely liquid asset that's already available. Now, that's it's neat, right? It's a party trick. But I think these are the incremental benefits that we have to start in order to get people to trust the technology itself and start trusting that there's financial assets that can be backed in cryptocurrencies and blockchain products. And I think we start moving forward from there. But it has to begin with trust and accessibility before we can create entirely new products.
Yeah. And it's also, many times when people ask me, what's the one thing that has to happen for, you know, the world that we all envision to become reality? I say time. Right. It's just, and it's time is a proxy for let entrepreneurs build companies, let investors find those entrepreneurs, give them capital, right? Let regulators educate themselves and begin to create rules that are kind of pro innovation, but still keep the scammers out. Let users kind of demystify this for themselves, right? Of like, Bitcoin's pretty scary for a lot of people, right? They've mm-hmm. heard that, you know, it can be stolen. They hear that criminals use it, all this stuff. When they start to understand, okay, you know, I get what it is. I understand how it works. I have an easy way to access it. You're just demystifying or reducing those barriers. So, and time brings a lot of that stuff.
It has to be time, but it also has to be within the time frame that people actually remember, right? The first time people...
So I disagree with that. Here's why. most of the products that are popular today, when they first were brought out into the world, no one used them. And not in it, it's like not even in the first day. Like email is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. I think email was created like early 80s, if I remember correctly.
Sure.
How many people were using email in 1993? Not that many, right? So you could argue that, well, email had a 20-year window, right? And that was still within the time that they remembered. I think this stuff just takes much, much longer. And so, you know, this idea of go back to, you know, every asset being tokenized, every stock, bond, currency, commodity being tokenized. Like if that takes 15 years, will we have all forgotten about it? Probably not. Will we have all of the hype and hoopla that maybe 2017 brought? Probably not. And so it's somewhere in between of like completely forgotten and like, this is going to change the world tomorrow.
I think there's merit there. I would say anybody that came into the stock market crash, the tech crash in 99, it took them a little bit of time in order to feel comfortable about investing in tech again. And the time when they felt comfortable was probably when the amount of capital that they're investing now is more than the amount of capital they lost in 1999. So the only way to get that back is unfortunately a price point that is somewhere reminiscent of whatever the price point was at their last entry. Mm-hmm. And sadly, if a lot of people entered in on $20,000, it's going to be a little bit of time probably until they feel like, okay, it's been 5 years. Goldman Sachs is offering this. It's at 25,000. You know, now I'll go in. Now it's legitimized.
Yep. I think that's fair. While we're on the topic of kind of the intersection between traditional markets, you know, traditional finance, et cetera, and crypto, what advice would you have for people that are in the traditional finance world? They've already mentally switched over and said, hey, this crypto blockchain thing is really interesting to me. I'd like to work on this for some part of the future of my career. How do I get started?
Oh, I love this. I love this. So our firm is based upon this kind of talent, right? Folks moving in from traditional finance, hedge funds, big banks, traders, all that have bought into the Kool-Aid. In fact, many of us were the same thing. Mm-hmm. There's a mindset in traditional finance of hierarchy, a focus on what you're doing, do it really well, and you'll be rewarded. Go up these rungs, these step ladder function, and you can get ahead. And if you don't, you got to move off to somewhere else that's a little bit easier. Okay, that's fine. But that's not the world of crypto, right? We have hired folks that are fresh out of school, that have spent 2 years in institutional finance, and now they run parts of the business, right? It's much more horizontal. And the application of that horizontalness within the entire industry is that everyone's kind of accessible. You're pretty accessible. I'm pretty accessible. You know, and we run decently sized businesses. Mm-hmm. So how do you, how does someone stand out in now that you know that there's 1,000 doors open? How do you know which one to go through, who to reach out to? I mean, it's pretty darn easy, right? If you're writing, if you're communicating, if you have your own independent conviction, share that with the world and you can get, it's pretty easy to get promoted on any of these blogs, or any of the websites. Many of our team actually now have started publishing their own thoughts. Ali publishes, Winford, Honor. These are all folks on our team that are independently blogging both for ourselves as well as for themselves. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get super smart, it's the same thing you do in traditional finance. Have a point of view. Believe in one aspect of the business and go super, super deep on it. Mm-hmm. Right? Everyone thinks that they're an inch deep in crypto. Because it's so hard to be smart in crypto. Mm-hmm. So hard. If you can be smart in any one topic, own it. Mm-hmm. And people will listen to you. So if you are a trader, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing technical analysis of Bitcoin. Great. Have your perspective on it. Own it. It's still your point of view. I assure you that the number of people from traditional finance that are getting into crypto is still smaller than the number of people that are in crypto from every other asset class. Mm-hmm. So you've actually got a huge edge, I think. The reality is there's a startup community in crypto that has never worked in traditional finance, has no idea how it operates. So if you are sub 5 years experience and you've worked in traditional finance, you have, I think, your pick of the litter in terms of joining venture-backed, high-quality startups right now. And if you ever, and you can reach out to me, I'm at Nikhil Kal, Nikhilkal on Twitter. And I can give you a long list of folks to that are looking for amazing jobs and that are hiring.
Yeah, that's good advice. What themes are you excited about in crypto?
Ooh, so my best themes we keep in our back pocket and wouldn't share, obviously. But some other themes that I'm happy to share.
I'm just going to start. I'm going to go to the store and buy some beer, give it to you, and then we'll get them out of here.
As if the beer's not on the table right now. No, it's traditional financial products with a slightly nuanced crypto spin on them is, I think, the best way to make a lot of money in a short amount of time in crypto.
Mm-hmm. And really what you're talking about is, if you think of like a Venn diagram, you've got hardcore decentralized the world crypto type mm-hmm. investment opportunities. And on the other side, you've got traditional financial products everyone understands. Yep. When you bring those two together, that overlap is really where you guys think is interesting.
I'll add another dimension to that chart. Think of it as like a 2x2 matrix. Mm-hmm. And you've got on one axis, you've got new firm versus old firm, mm-hmm. like you know, Blackstone versus company startup X. Mm-hmm. And then you've got new idea versus old idea on the other axis. Mm-hmm. And so you've got four boxes. And the ideal places to be are a new firm with an old idea mm-hmm. or an old respected firm with a new idea. Mm-hmm. The other two boxes are really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Old firm, old idea, tired. New firm, new idea, too scary and risky for a lot of investors.
Uphill battle. Yeah, we talk all the time that whenever there's a new piece of technology that's created, you can do one of two things. You can either build things with it that the world's never seen, or you can use it to improve the old world. Mm-hmm. And most of what I would call hardcore Silicon Valley is go build new things. The bigger, from a addressable market and market cap standpoint, the bigger opportunity is actually to take that new technology and improve the old world.
Exactly. And that's what we're seeing right now. So for example, I've got a thesis that horizontal plays within financial services are going to be the first applications of blockchain tech that we see at scale.
Okay, explain that.
So the reality is that all the big financial institutions have done some proof of concepts that have go back to 2014, 2013 even. And that's great. They've got some 10 to 50 people inside the business that are familiar with the tech or heard of it or responsible for managing people or funding it. Great. So there's some education that's already happened institutionally, and that takes years. And those years have already transpired. That has happened across, I don't know, how many financial institutions have done anything in crypto internally?
Probably all of them have looked at it.
Right. Right. That's extraordinary. So let's say there's 6,000 or 8,000 of these like legitimate firms around the world, and they've all, 5,500 of them have done something, I would say. And that's great. So now they're smart on it being something that they are allowed to look at and allowed to explore. Mm-hmm. They recognize that a completely verticalized application is not going to be ripped out and replaced. Mm-hmm. Just try taking any single application within an old world regulated firm, ERP tech, or financial modeling, or even your QuickBooks, mm-hmm. really basic things that are applicable across any company, and it's very, very hard to rip those out. Mm-hmm. So my suggestion is, if you can create a product that's applicable across the entire industry, then you've got 6,000 to 8,000 customers out there already ready to buy it. All right. You're not going to be replacing, an entire vertical group. So the examples of these are, that everyone throws around would be KYC AML. They're applicable to everyone. Mm-hmm. You're not saying they're doing a whole new KYC and AML process. No, everyone's going to have their jobs. There's going to be a slight improvement. It's going to cost a lot more, but it does everything that's already happened and then some. That's like the first layer. Mm-hmm. Where I think it starts to fail in the vision that's, contemplated everywhere else is non-financial services, entirely vertical plays. Mm-hmm. So everyone wants to point to supply chain. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the hardest application for cryptocurrency and blockchain tech.
Why?
It's global by nature. You're dealing with multiple governments. Inherently, it's step function harder than dealing with one government. Dealing with one government alone is really, really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Two, it is mission critical kind of tech for the companies you're servicing. Mm-hmm. That's in one essence good because people have incentive to do it, mm-hmm. but you don't replace tech that's mission critical ever. Mm-hmm. Right? You just legally can't get around it. It means too much. There's a lot of protection. You really don't screw around with the cash cow. If it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. So KYC and AML, while it's in the critical path of doing business, it's not generally revenue generating for financial services. It's something that people always want to lower their costs on. And it's just a completely different sales process. Mm-hmm. If you explain to me how much more money blockchain can make for some of these companies, sure. But right now, it's, I think, largely seen as a cost savings mechanism, which is a harder sell. But I think it's the only sell in the near term for financial services firms. For these massive industries that are trying to replace entire vertical stacks, that's super, super hard. Mm-hmm. The friction in the sales process, the friction of proving it out is a too high hurdle, I think, right now. And more importantly, usually these entire vertical stacks get swapped out when there's a hammer that forces you to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? The Chinese government says, you must do this. Or Walmart says, supply, you know, my entire supply chain, you must have RFID tags in every single shipment or something like that. That is how you completely change a vertical stack. That's really, really hard across, you know, a grouping of people that are collectively trying to, you know, do this together, mm-hmm. As opposed to someone saying, you must do this. Mm-hmm.
All right, before we continue with this conversation, I want to mention our sponsor again, BlockFi. Remember, they do crypto lending. So you posted your crypto as collateral, they give you a US dollar loan, and you can use the US dollars to do whatever you want. You should visit BlockFi.com/pomp and then tweet at me that you went. If you tweet at me after you went to BlockFi.com/pomp, maybe I'll throw you a like, a smiley face, or the fire emoji. The fire emoji is the best. Remember, go to BlockFi.com/pomp and I'll see you on Twitter.
What's your take on other things that are interesting? So what you described with like the KYC AML, that's essentially building technology as a service, right? Mm-hmm. It is a service today that, yeah, there's some technology solutions, there's some that's done manually, but if you can come in, you can build technology that automates or makes more efficient that process, there'd be incredibly valuable. What's one or two others that are similar to that that you think would be either one interesting for entrepreneurs to look at or two would be valuable for potential customers to be pitched?
Settlement is probably the biggest opportunity today. It takes, you know, a day to 5 days to settle most transactions. And I'm not even talking about, you know, inter-country transactions, you know. Everybody likes to throw out the idea of real estate. I think there's probably much faster, simpler products out there. So if just look at one company. So if you're inside a big bank right now, ask yourself, what are the slowest intra-bank settlement times, right? You know, you've got instant, I'm sure, you know, checking account of a traditional commercial bank, you know, is pretty fast. But I assure you, as soon as you get away from this hyper liquid stuff, it gets much, much, much harder. Mm-hmm. So those, I think, are going to be the first ones, because now you're dealing with a regulatory environment and a decision making process that's so much faster. Mm-hmm. You know, things that are on the opposite end of the spectrum, the worst that is, remittance, mm-hmm. I think is wildly difficult for crypto today. And yeah, there's some great stories with Ripple. There's some great stories with a handful of other companies that have done 9-figure remittances that I've seen at least. Mm-hmm. But you know, again, two governments is 3 times harder than one government.
Mm-hmm. What if you're a retail investor, right? You don't have, let's say, all of the opportunities today, just given the regulations to invest in anything, right? So there's some private offerings that are only available to accredited investors. I think most people in the space would wish that they were open to everyone. They're not because of regulations. Hopefully that changes in the future. But if you're a retail investor today, how would you think about crypto as an investment opportunity, right? So not necessarily like, hey, what would you go invest in, but much more around is buying equity interesting? Is investing in some of the liquid tokens interesting? Are there specific themes that you would look at? Just how would you maybe explain to people, if you're a retail investor, this is the way to look at it?
So every retail investor most retail investors think on too short a timeline. Right, the compounding effects of money take time. And so if you're looking for a get rich quick sort of thing, I don't think you should think of cryptocurrency as that angle anymore. Hopefully it's a real asset class, and real asset classes have a much higher level of trust, a little bit lower level of volatility than what we saw in 2016, 2017, and even 2018 for that matter. So if I was a retail investor out there, I would think of, you know, what's in my price range, you know, what's in my investment horizon, right? And how does this diversify from what I have already? Mm-hmm. Right? If you are mostly illiquid and you've got a very tiny amount of liquid investable assets to your name, you know, let's call it, you know, 50% of your net worth, right, is liquid, and it's, you know, money that could otherwise go to your savings and, you know, your rainy day or 6 months of buffer, right? That's not investable assets, mm-hmm. right? That's money that you should be careful with and treat it as like your core, you know, money in case anything goes wrong. Now, if you do have a bunch of money left over, right, the way I think about investing is what can absolutely go to zero and it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. right? And that's the stuff that I would put towards, you know, the most risky assets. And that includes startups. That's angel investing. Mm-hmm. That includes things where I'm learning. And a lot of folks, unfortunately, put some cash into crypto that should have been into that at that bucket. And I've heard a number of really challenging horror stories. The biggest horror stories I've seen are around tax unawareness and people not realizing that they made a bunch of money and they reinvested it from 2017 into 2018 into tokens. And then they owed money on 2017, but then they lost all of it in the reinvestment in 2018. Mm-hmm. And they owe, and guess what? Taxes, you know, even if you call BK, you know, you still got to pay those off mm-hmm. no matter what. Okay. So what should people do? This is where the question started. If I was investing in the equity of crypto companies, I would want to be in the traditional piece of the cap stack today, because I've seen most of the token economics and governance be very punitive to investors. So reading the terms on those documents is super, super, super important. Mm-hmm. Now, so what I look at is, and what I look for are entrepreneurs that are fully aware of the alignment of their investors mm-hmm. with common shareholders. Mm-hmm. And it's actually really hard because it's constantly changing. And most entrepreneurs don't really care about being smart on this. They care about building their business. Mm-hmm. And money is a means to an end for them to get to their vision. So why are they going to spend time being super smart on this? If they're not super smart on it and can't explain to the investors, and yet investors are really, really screwed. So when I was at SoftBank, we were tasked with an interesting challenge. It was coming up with the top 100 companies. And we said back to Masa and Co. Masa's the founder and CEO of SoftBank. What do you mean top 100? And he's like, top 100. And so we kind of had to read between the lines. This is top 100 companies to invest in, to buy, to do partnerships with. I mean, in the world, mm-hmm. right? It's pretty wild. It's an amazing thought exercise if you haven't done it already. You know, if you had a magic wand and you could have equity in the, you know, any companies in the world that you wanted, which ones would they be? And that's not even getting to what if it wasn't equity. Mm-hmm. That's a lot harder. But the interesting thing is you start with that question, and then you realize, okay, if I know these are the best companies, right, can I structure a deal that makes it the most valuable asset for me? Mm-hmm. So that was a really, really interesting exercise for me. And it got me to think on another planar level in terms of what are the most valuable assets in the world. Because assets are really, as an investor, they're not just the underlying value creation that's happening in the company. Mm-hmm. It's also the structure around it. Mm-hmm. So this is how I got here from your question of how does the structure, you know, influence, you know, how you're buying equity. And for me, that's just an example, a permutation of how does structure affect being an investor of any kind. So really, well, the way SoftBank, you know, operated when I was there, when you're trying to do these extraordinary deals, was really simple. It's like, look, I love you. You might like me. Here's an offer that I think will make us both a lot of money. And oh, by the way, if you don't take it, I might give it to someone else. Mm-hmm. And it's an honest, very transparent, hard negotiating strategy that tended to work out for the better. And I've seen it done a few times. I'd say the best thing I ever learned from SoftBank was the art of negotiation. And it served me well since then.
What's the number one thing you learned about negotiating from SoftBank?
always be willing to walk away from the deal.
Any examples you want to give?
No. Definitely not.
I thought I set him up for that one.
Emotion plays no role in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Excitement plays no role in this sort of thing. In fact, I recall there was a deal that Atit and I were trying to do last year, and we had a very, very big meeting to iron out terms mm-hmm. On an extremely strategic deal for us. And, you know, he calls me up right afterwards or messaged me, I forget what it was. And he's like, how do you feel right afterwards? And I said, no feelings. And that's how I knew we were on the right path. We made the step in the right direction. There can't be any emotion on these kinds of things.
For sure. And you've previously talked about moonshot investing, which is this idea of going after things that are pretty binary in outcome, but if they are successful, they are beyond our wildest dreams of what a company could accomplish and what the returns could be, et cetera. How do you apply that to crypto? How do you think about that?
Oh, I think about this every day. This is one of my favorite things. Luke, can I take you back to a story before I answer?
Of course.
So basically after...
This is, by the way, podcasts are basically just story time for adults.
Story time? Okay, yeah. Good. Go ahead. Here's a fun thought exercise, and everyone at home should think about doing this too. I have a group of friends. We all became best friends. They're extraordinary entrepreneurs in the world. You've probably heard of them. Mm-hmm. Not Elon Musk, but a couple of them are at that level. And we all catch up pretty regularly. And we went to the strip one time and we all were deciding what we wanted to do with our next chapter with our lives. We'd been fortunate. We've had a bunch of success or we've had a bunch of failures too. That's for sure. And we happened to be at this point in our lives at the same time. We had a little bit more time to think about what it is we wanted to do next. Mm-hmm. And the question came up was, well, let's say all the world's resources are ours. Cause we really feel like we've unlimited resources, within arm's reach. What is the most undervalued asset in the world? Mm-hmm. Is it a person? Is it a group of people? Is it a piece of real estate? Is it a technology? I don't know. And so we...
Time.
And then can we acquire the asset and let's go acquire it? And so we did. We spent like 18 months of time focused on this sort of thing. And went around and tried to find it. It ended up being a amazing thought exercise. The actual economics behind it were nearly wildly lucrative. It ended up becoming a failed project in the end. But I can tell you through that exercise, we brought in some of the world's most powerful investors together. We built this, plans to build a $10 billion, clean energy redevelopment project in America. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. Now, some of those folks are involved in the crypto world. Most of them are in energy and in tech. And the application of that thinking was really simple. What is something that's actually unobtainable today? Mm-hmm. And then let's flip it on its head. Let's just say we could get it. Mm-hmm. Right? What are the characteristics of things that are unattainable? How do we create a framework around that and to identify the top 10 things in the world that are unattainable that we think could be worth something if we were to make it accessible? And that's kind of how I think about crypto today. Like what is completely impossible mm-hmm. today that through the use of this technology that I believe in, that you believe in, could be worth, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars mm-hmm. or maybe even more. And so that's one of the frameworks that we think about. And yeah, it's a lot of pie in the sky, but we very quickly turn it down into actionable investment theses that we then go.
So let's talk about co-venture crypto, right? Sure. So if this is kind of your background, your perspective, and the thoughts that you spend on a daily basis, what exactly is co-venture crypto and what the heck are you guys doing every day?
Yeah. So very simply, co-venture crypto intends to provide institutional grade access to cryptocurrency products. We are a part of co-venture, which has multiple sleeves, venture, credit, and crypto. And, we've got some extraordinary backers ranging from high net worth individuals to SBI Holdings, formerly known as SoftBank Investments, which is a large publicly traded financial institution that that seeded our business. So we think of the world as institutional investors will come in. It's going to take time. Let's build products right now that we can monetize, whether that's strategies around asset management, as well as products that can be distributed through retail and approved by governments, whether that's the SEC or the FSA or other jurisdictions of the world. So our strategy is diversified. You know, I like to think of ourselves as a data company. We try to source data from all these different brains. These brains being people, as well as companies, as well as infrastructure, as well as partnerships. And we've built, you know, many of these already. We're collecting this data, and then we try to turn that into proprietary data infrastructure and proprietary data itself that we can then monetize. Most of that today is monetized through trading, but we've also expanded into venture, and now we're expanding into other categories as well.
Very cool. Where do you see institutional investors today? What's kind of been your touch points with them and what they're thinking about right now in January of 2018, February 2018?
Institutional investors today.
Or I guess it's 2019.
Yeah, 19.
I'm a year behind.
That's okay. Institutional investors are currently concerned over, is this asset class going to be around forever? Right. I'd put this at the lowest point of institutional conviction that I've seen. It's really, really scary. That being said, this is the most optimal time to make investments into the sector. Equity valuations have gone down the most. The number of applications have dramatically increased. Every day you're hearing about tier one caliber institutions getting in. And once that credibility comes in, I think it will alleviate a lot of the concerns that are in there. I'm tired of hearing about how X company is coming in and is going to launch something in Q1 of this year or next year, or is going to launch this thing, and it's going to be big and it's going to be huge. I think everyone's tired of that. The person who's most tired of hearing that is the institutions themselves. It's great. Fidelity, March, please come in. We can't wait. I'd much rather hear about them having launched than that they're going to be launched. And that's actually a huge difference between the venture community and the institutional investor community. The institutional investor community loves to talk about things they've already done, you know, and the tech and venture community loves to announce things 6 months before they're before they're actually starting work on it.
For sure. Well, let's go through one of the deals you guys did, right? You guys publicly announced that you invested in Nomix, right? And maybe just talk about what that is, what got you guys excited, kind of how you think about that business moving forward.
Yeah, sure. So our DNA is tech, trading, and data. All of us have a background in engineering and traditional finance, and we've been able to parlay that into investments in those kind of subsectors. Nomix basically takes a very different approach to the same sector, where they are an API company that is educating a lot of the exchanges and, frankly, is becoming the back end for a lot of the exchanges and the trading venues out there. That's exactly what we've been doing in the background as well. We have spent months and months with several exchanges telling them, well, this is how institutional investors think. This is how a sophisticated trading team would want to engage with your exchange. These are all the hurdles you need to take from a regulatory perspective. We're not getting paid consulting fees for these types of things. We're getting paid in opportunities to invest before anyone else. Nomix is a really great example of a company you believed in. I mean, the investment thesis is made public. We've already blogged about it. Clay Collins is an extraordinary entrepreneur. Great successes. We believe in Clay, and I think he'll have an even bigger success here. There's another company that we haven't announced an investment in where we've been partnering with them for 6 months. We've been working with them, and we were able to get them to open up a round of investment just for us originally. And, you know, that's an example of, you know, being hunters, not being responsive. And I think the best venture folks are all hunters. If you look at Gurley, you know, Greylock, Benchmark, you know, Sequoia, the big funds out there, they're best investors are all hunters. They're not just reacting to the deal flow that comes in their way. Mm-hmm. And our best way to hunt is to use our sharpest arrows and knives, and those are around trading and data. So anything that's an exchange or a trading venue or derivatives or offering an institutional kind of trading product, whether that's prime brokers and this quote unquote institutional structure, infrastructure for trading, that everyone, this mythical infrastructure that everybody keeps talking about needs to be built. That's the stuff that we're looking at, mostly because that's the background we came from. Mm-hmm. And that's what we know best. So we're anything that we don't see out there, we may even try to build ourselves.
Very cool. Before I wrap up, I usually do a rapid fire of questions. Lately, people have been making it not rapid fire, so we're going to try to make it rapid fire. What do you think is the most important company in crypto?
China.
Why? That's not a company for the record, but go ahead.
It was fast though. Now you slowed it down. You know that.
No, it's another question. Why? Why China?
They single-handedly have focused the energies of, I would say, the second most important global mind of engineering talent around blockchain tech as opposed to crypto trading. And the second that they reverse that opinion, I think that trading venues around the world will have their hand forced.
Are they ahead or behind the United States
ahead.
Technology? Ahead. All right. What's the most controversial thought you have in crypto? When people hear this, most people are going to disagree with you on.
Oh, the winners of most of the subsectors in crypto will be determined by who's got the most runway.
Really? Oh, I'm going to completely disagree with that. I love this. Wait, explain why.
You're in crypto winter right now. The number of companies, number of distressed companies out there that are great is wildly high. I'd put it at, 2000, the year 2000 kind of levels. Mm-hmm. If you've got a lot of money out there, you can sit and wait this one out. Mm-hmm. If you don't, it doesn't matter how the grade of your talent, you are in a tough position. There's an old adage, right? It's about, you're a great employee of a company, or you're at a great company, or you're in a great industry, right? Which one of those three leads to the most success? Mm-hmm. Do you have an answer?
The one that leads to the most success, and I'm going to sidestep the exact question, but I'm going to say the people who are most successful are the people who are surrounded by the rest of the most successful people.
Surrounded by, what do you mean by that? Meaning they work with them?
Work with them, for them.
If you're on a rocket ship, it doesn't matter if you're a C player or a D player, right? You are going to benefit massively.
Yeah. If you're around a bunch of winners, then you win.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's why I disagree. The companies that I think are currently executing the best are likely to be the companies that have raised smaller amounts of money, right? The companies who raise tons of money are actually not performing. I tweeted about this the other day. I said, if you're a company that raised in 2017 and we're in 2019, and you still haven't released your product yet, the odds that you're going to be sustainable or valuable are incredibly low.
Yep.
And the other data point would be that even though we're in a bear market, the best companies will still get funded. So let's say that in 17, during all the hype, 100% of companies get funded. I'm making this up. If in a bear market, only 10% of companies get funded that would have gotten funded in 2017, investors hopefully have good enough filter that those are the 10 best percent companies. And therefore, if you're good, you don't care if it's a bull or bear market, you're still able to get the funding you need.
Totally fair for companies being invested in now. Mm-hmm. Companies that already exist that have a 2 or 3 year head start that are going to be around in 2 years. Maybe they've already got 2 years of product out there. If you get a 2 year head start on launching a product in a subsector, that's pretty extraordinary. If they never launch a product, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you haven't launched a product and you got $500 million in your balance sheet, you're going to fail.
I'm going to say this right now, and somebody somewhere will pull this up when I'm wrong. Less than three companies that raised money in 2017 and now in 2019 have not released a product yet, less than three of them will be around in 10 years.
Okay.
Because my guess is that, let's say that there's, probably 100, 200 companies that raised money in 17, still have not released their product in 2019. Less than three of those companies will be around. We'll see.
Yeah.
So trust me, somebody's going to save this on the internet.
Exactly.
Come back to me.
Two archives.
All right. What, if you could wave a magic wand and change or improve one regulation, what would it be?
Ooh, I would... let's see. I would love to have extreme clarity on KYC AML requirements for companies that hold crypto.
It's fair.
It's one of the biggest blockers, I think, for financial institutions coming in. Right? And that might be solved through custody solutions, it might be solved through a tech solution, it might be solved by just declaring, hey, you must have a letter from, you know, lawyers from each person you take money from, whatever it is.
Yep.
But just something that would solve it would, I think, would be phenomenal.
Okay. Most important book you've ever read?
Most important, Ender's Game had a huge influence on me. You know, I read it when I was really young. Ender's Game is a sci-fi kind of book. There's a movie on it. I think it was not that great. And I learned a lot about resilience, about fighting for what you believe in, even when it's hard. I mean, I think I was, what, like 17 when I read it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say as an adult, my absolute favorite book that had wide-ranging impacts on me, which is a much harder thing to get, is the book that we actually named our one of our funds off of. You can edit this part, right? thank you. The book that had the greatest influence on me as an adult is called Three Body Problem. And Three Body Problem is by, I'm going to butcher the name, but and a Chinese guy named Cixin Liu. And it is a mind-expanding story. It was very popular last year, actually. I think Obama mentioned it a couple times or whatever it is. But
Three Body Problem. All right. So sticking on that, I only asked one non-crypto question.
Are there non-crypto questions?
Yeah, of course. Well, there's alien questions, which this is. Do you think that there are pets or alien animals? We always think of aliens as like the equivalent of humans, right? Kind of single species. When they get off the spaceship, are they bringing animals or pets with them?
No. I mean, if you're landing on a foreign planet, like you're there for business.
All right.
You think they're there for vacation?
So you don't think that they would bring crazy. Their animals or pets with them? But what about at their... in their home, I guess we'll call it.
Do I think aliens have pets?
Yeah.
Sure.
Why?
Companionship, I don't think is a human trait. I think it's probably a, you know, look, animals in America, on Earth, like.
Do animals have pets?
I think animals have other relationships that wouldn't be defined as pets, but defined as a collaborative species.
Like I don't
species.
See a donkey running around with like a turtle on a leash, right?
You've got animals that depend on other animals in their microsystem.
Right. That's fair.
You know, whether that's for companionship or for sustenance, it's probably a combination of both.
That's fair.
Right? Dolphins play, right?
Yeah, dolphins play. Some of our pets, like, well, not pets, I guess animals are farmed for specifically eating, but yeah, that's fine. I follow up or I end each podcast with letting you ask me one question. What one question do you have for me?
Let's see. This is the fun time where I just get to make fun of you, right?
Yeah, that's
like
fine.
That's the whole thing.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Who is the greatest influence on your personal life, not in your professional life? Doesn't count. Your significant other doesn't count.
My parents, easily.
Mm-hmm.
But
what have they done for you lately? Just kidding.
Probably too much.
Choose one.
I can't. They do everything together. It's
you,
like if you ask
you
them,
you have to answer the question right now.
Yeah, I wouldn't. no, I mean, look, it depends on how you'd ask it, right? Who had the most impact on me, in terms of probably my ethics and morals and like everything around like how I think as a human? Probably my mother, just because she spent the most time with us as kids, right? And then if you said to me how I interact with the world, right? And how I think from a framework standpoint, et cetera, probably my father, because that's how we spent the most time together. And then I grew up in a house with four brothers. So you can imagine, there was like, that's why Twitter doesn't really bother me that much. Like mm-hmm. every person in my life who ever talked shit to me actually loved me.
Were you the little one?
And I'm the oldest. So it's even better.
Oh, you act like a little one though.
Yeah. You know, it's fine because when whether you act like the old one or the little one, when you've got four younger brothers, you just beat them all up.
Yeah. So.
No, but
was that what you see Twitter like? Just beating
But everyone who you know how many times as a kid I came home and one of my brothers was like, "You're an idiot," and I was like, "Oh, you must have had a bad day." Like,
yeah,
you want to go play video games?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure, right? Like, Twitter's kind of the same thing. Right? There's people who literally I don't even block them anymore. Like, there's people who just responded like, "You're dumb." Okay, thanks. Have a great day.
Sure,
move on. So yeah, that's not an answer.
I was the youngest. So
you got beat up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I had one older sister.
So you definitely got beat up
big time, big time. Oh yeah. Yeah. She's 5 years older, but my family is very, you know, we had the typical immigrant story, right?
Yep.
It was, you know, it was a rough going the first bit, and then it got a lot easier as, you know, parents are able to, you know, move on in the world and do something themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, Twitter's a different animal.
I've got a whole theory that people on Twitter are what's the saying? Money doesn't make you; it just reveals who you already were.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter's the same way. Like sitting behind a keyboard just reveals who you actually are.
Mm-hmm.
You say all the things that you wish that you could say to the guy on the subway who cut you off, or you know, to the nice person who you see at the bar that you wish you could say a compliment to, but you don't want to be creepy.
Right.
And like if you're a nice person, you're nice on Twitter. If you're an asshole, you're an asshole on Twitter, and that's fine. All right, man. I appreciate
it. This was fun. Thanks.
This is a lot of fun. We will we'll have to do it again. Thank you so much for coming, and best of luck.
Appreciate it. Take care.
All right. You reached the end of the podcast. Congratulations. I appreciate you listening all the way to the end. You deserve a trophy. But before I hand out the virtual trophies, remember to go visit BlockFi.com/pomp. They're the crypto lending leader in the US. They do it in 45 states, interest rates as low as 8%, and you can use the US dollars funded directly to your bank account to do whatever you want. You should definitely go visit BlockFi.com/pomp. You know you want to do it, so just do it. BlockFi.com/pomp.
Hey everyone, Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.